You can sit with us podcast with Lexi B.
Adia Gooden is a licensed clinical psychologist. She received her BA in psychology from Stanford University and her PhD in clinical community psychology from DePaul University. Dr. Adia served as a staff psychologist and the coordinator for multicultural outreach and support for the Student Counseling Service at the University of Chicago and the director of the clinic and community programs at the Family Institute at Northwestern before starting her own business. Dr. Adia is a sought-after dynamic speaker who gives talks and workshops on unconditional self-worth, imposter syndrome, and Black women's mental health. She's also co-authored the book Promoting Black Women's Mental Health, published by Cambridge University Press. Dr. Adia gave a TEDx talk called Cultivating Unconditional Self-Worth, which has over 1 million views. She also hosts the Unconditionally Worthy podcast and coaches high-achieving professional women to embrace their unconditional self-worth.
You Can Sit With Us podcast with Lexi B.
Welcome, Adia. How are you?
I'm good. Happy to be here with you.
Yay! And I'm so excited to have you because we did not go to school at the same time, even though for folks who don't know, Adia does look like she's still 16 because Black don't crack. But we did not go to school at the same time, but I have always admired you from afar. So I'm very grateful for you being here with me today.
Thank you. I've admired you from afar as well, even though we didn't cross paths. So I'm glad to be connecting in this way.
Yay. Okay. So let's get started. What's in your coffee cup? What you drinking with us?
Hot chocolate. I love making my own hot chocolate. I'm a chocolate addict. So that's my source of caffeine and source of like pleasure and enjoyment in the morning.
I think that we should double down on that. You make your own hot chocolate, which I've never heard of in my entire life. I'm more of a Keurig hot chocolate or go to Starbucks or I forgot what it's called. But back in the day, the hot chocolate mix things that you would get at the grocery store in the blue box.
Right? Swiss Miss. Yeah. Yeah.
Kudos to Swiss Miss. Yes. In the 90s. So how does one make their own hot chocolate in their regular, degular kitchen?
Well, I heat up my oat milk because I'm lactose intolerant. Yeah. So I heat up my oat milk. I put 2 tablespoons of cacao powder, 1/2 tablespoon of honey, a little cinnamon, a little salt, and then I mix it with my immersion blender. And then you have delicious hot chocolate.
That's wild. I keep telling people this season is just full of these people who make their own things. We have somebody who makes her own mint tea from the garden. I was like, wow, okay. You know, we got people who are making ginger root tea. And they are just cutting up ginger. I was like, okay, so y'all are just Harry Pottering in the kitchen. And I love to, you know what? I go for it. Go be great. Okay. So with your homemade, literally hot chocolate, where are your people from?
Yeah, it's so funny when you were saying the ginger tea and the mint tea, I was like, I wonder if there's like Caribbean ancestry because I make a good amount of ginger tea because of my dad, who is from Jamaica. So my dad's side, Jamaican, and my mom's side, DC, African-American. So my mom is probably like, I don't know what it is, like 6th generation Washington, DC, or-ite, however you want to say that. So yeah, enslaved ancestors on both sides of my family, just some in the Caribbean and some in the U.S.
So did you grow up in D.C.?
No, I grew up in Southern California. So my parents met in New Haven, Connecticut, moved to Chicago, and then moved to California. And that's where I grew up. They actually live back in D.C. now, but I spent my childhood teenage years in California. So I claim SoCal.
New Haven's such an interesting place. I went to New Haven once to go visit, you know, an unknown school called Yale. And I remember it being very, Yale and New Haven look very different. Let's just put it out there. And for folks who have not been, you should go to that Yale Gate New Haven border. It's different.
Very different. My parents met at Yale because my dad went there for graduate school. But he was like very involved in the community and like doing some stuff with the Panthers back in the day and like had a community house and all of that stuff. But he was definitely straddling that border. certainly.
Yes. For folks who don't know, just Google it. It's wild. It is. I remember my 17-year-old self looking at my mother on campus and I was like, oh, they didn't put this in the brochure. Mm. They didn't talk about this in the brochure. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. So you are a very renowned and well-known psychologist working in multi-layered spaces. That's how I want to call it. But I think that one thing that you're really, really known for is really helping people understand their self-worth, which I think is very important considering that we live in a world that does not want us to know our self-worth, at least in my opinion. They do not want us to know that. And at least growing up, I feel like I was just ingrained with information that lovingly told me that my self-worth was secondary to everything else. How did you get started in this space? Why was this important to you?
I mean, it started with my struggle, my own struggles with self-worth. So around age 12, I just felt like there was something wrong with me. I wasn't bullied, thankfully, right? Like there was no sort of like external serious trauma that I was navigating, but I just felt left out. I felt excluded. I just didn't feel like who I was good enough. And I really tried to solve this in a lot of ways, right? So I tried to solve this through like perfect academic performance. I tried to solve it through being a selfless friend who was always there for everyone else, never asked anything of anyone. I eventually, you know, later in my life, like after college, tried to solve it through relationships. But I really spent a lot of time trying to use external things to prove that I was worthy. And for me, that culminated when I passed my dissertation defense and all I felt was empty and exhausted, because that was sort of one of my final frontiers. It was sort of like, okay, if I get these three letters behind my name, if I have my PhD, then I will feel worthy. And I knew immediately that it didn't work. And that meant that. So I was just like, okay, I've got to do something different. I've got to search for something internal. And so I was in therapy and I did a lot of soul searching and meditating and practicing what I preached as a therapist. And then when I was doing my own work, when I was working as a clinical psychologist, I was working with these high achieving students because I was at, you know, a top university in their counseling center. And I was seeing that they had the same problem. They were having the same challenges. So they were, you know, really smart, really high achieving, had all of this stuff going for them, but feeling like they weren't worthy. And so that really helped me to see like, okay, this isn't just a me problem. This is a more universal problem. And I want to help people solve it. I want to help people understand that they are unconditionally worthy and to tap into that truth.
I want to talk more about the students at the college, because I think that college is such a pivotal age, right? That 18 to 22, if we're talking about undergrad, such a pivotal age. You have no idea what life is, even though you think you know what life is. What kinds of questions were they asking or concerns they were coming to you with where you said, oh, this is all about self-worth?
That is a good question. I think it was the, I'm doing really well in school, but I feel awful about myself and I'm beating myself up for every single mistake, right? So the hyper self-criticism, the feeling like, if I don't succeed, if I fail, and fail in this context was like get a B, you know, then I'm like unworthy, right? Like I feel awful and beating myself up. Like I don't know where to go, right? Like I think about my clients who just were experiencing such deep pain and despair, right? They're at one of the top universities in the country. They're doing well overall, but they felt so much despair, self-loathing, self-criticism, fear of, you know, not following what their parents wanted them to do. This is often the narrative of the children of immigrants, of first-generation college students who feel like I have to get this science degree, be pre-med, be a lawyer, be an engineer, etc. And I don't want to do that, but I feel like I'm failing and letting everyone down if I don't do that, right? So all of these sort of internal pressures, feeling of external pressure, and just a lot of like feeling really badly about themselves. Like the thoughts and feelings they would have about themselves were really harsh and negative.
That makes me really sad. And it makes me sad because I remember being that age and also having similar feelings. As a Black American kid, not having the feeling of I have to be a doctor, but definitely having the feeling of whatever I choose to do, whether it's medicine or basket weaving, I have to be the best at it. And I have to make my family look good. And you know, at 18, what that means, make your family look good, is so is very different than what it means to me now as an adult. But that's very interesting that we are still having that conversation a generation later, a generation and a half later. To get into that, what do you think society, what are we doing to continue to perpetuate these ideas or these themes that we still have these kids at 18, 22 years old having the same conversations with themselves that we did?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, it struck me when you said in the opening, like, the society doesn't want us to know that we're worthy. And, you know, our society in a lot of ways is built on, you know, people buying things in order to feel more worthy, right? To be more beautiful, for more people to love you, for more people to like you, people overworking to feel more worthy, right? Like if you just get the job, get the promotion, get the award, right? Like make sure you're 40 under 40, whatever it is, then you'll feel worthy. And in so many ways, we have a society that's constructed around proving your worth versus owning your worth and then going out and sharing your gifts in a way that's aligned and impactful. And so I think, you know, people get the message that the harder you work, the more you produce, the more worthy you are. People get the message that the quote unquote prettier you are, and usually that's based on white European standards, the thinner you are, the whatever, right, you are, if you are more of it, that means that you are more worthy. And that's communicated explicitly at times. And it's also communicated through the messages, through who we see getting treated well, getting affirmed, getting supported, who has the money to do what they want and need to do, who has the access, who has the power. And so I think there are a lot of ways in which we are set up by our society and by all of the messages that we receive to believe that we have to do something different or be something different in order to be worthy.
So what does this look like in the corporate space, right? So we've kind of dabbled in how it manifests when you're in your younger years, trying to figure out what is adulting and what is life. But with your patients, clients, and practice, I know that you do a lot of work with corporate women. What does that look like? What are the kinds of concerns that you're seeing that are presented to you?
I mean, I think it looks like a lot of overworking and overextending, right? There's a sense of, I just have to do one more thing. I have to keep working. I have to keep producing because that is where my worth lies more than in who I am and my natural gifts and strengths, right? There's this always doing. And I think particular for BIPOC women, for Black women, we tend to be in roles where we are sort of handling everything, right? We're leading the diversity committee. We're maybe chairing the social committee and gathering, you know, helping mentor people. We're doing all of the things and we are doing our job, right? So there's sort of this extra workload, this feeling of I always have to keep going. I have to be strong. I can't expect help, support. I can't take time off, right? So all of these pressures while also navigating gendered racism, sexism, racism, all of those things, right, is a whole lot. And that stress builds up and it leads to burnout and it can keep people from actually enjoying the work that initially they might have been really excited to do. Because, you know, when you're overworking and overextending and burned out, it's really hard to joyfully engage in your work or joyfully share your gifts and strengths.
Yeah, yeah. And I do want to highlight what you said about the overworking, the number of times that people go to these corporate places and, you know, the narrative around we're a family and, you know, community culture and all these things. And people get so ingrained to it that, girl, they're out here doing 3, 4, 5 jobs on top of their day job. And then the consequence of that is you only have 24 hours in a day. So sometimes your day job lacks. And so while the top people of the company are saying, this is great. We're so glad that all of you are so ingrained in the culture and are part of these very much volunteer activities. When it's time for your performance review and your manager dings you for not actually getting your day job done, it can be very defeating, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, and I think that's one of those things where it's like, you're not told those rules, right? So you just kind of think, oh, okay, so if I just keep showing up and keep doing all these things and I volunteer for this and I volunteer for that, I'll just get extra credits and I'll get bonuses and people will be really happy and I'll get affirmed, right? Because that's sort of the way it worked in high school and college, right? Like you do the extracurriculars, you do all of this stuff. It looks really good. Then colleges are happy and they let you in, and you do the same thing in college and then grad schools are happy and they let you in. But then something shifts when you actually go into the workforce, which is great. Yeah. If you want to do all that extra stuff, that's great. But no, it's not really counting towards your performance review. I remember I applied to an academic job and they wanted me to do all of this community outreach and relationship building with community partners. And in the interview, I said, well, how is this going to be counted towards tenure? Or how is service counted towards tenure? And they were basically like, it barely is, right? So they were really excited for me to do all this work. But what I realized was they were not going to credit me for it. So I would have been spending a lot of time doing a lot of work to benefit this department. And then, as we're saying, when it would have been time for tenure review, they would have been like, but where are those publications? And I think often it is a setup like that, right? Because the rules are unwritten. And so we go in being our high achieving, overachiever, handle everything, do everything selves. And then we're not told these rules, we're overextending, and we end up burning out and not even getting credit for a lot of the work that we're doing, as you're saying.
Yeah, y'all, don't get caught up. Don't get caught up. I did that once when I was 23. Never again, Adia. Never again. Never, ever, ever again. So when these women are coming to you having these conversations, I'm sure it's something like, I don't know what to do. This is what it is. My question to you is, I guess the first step is to help them navigate their own definition of self-worth. In your opinion and in your feedback and practice, how do you get someone to understand that? Because that's such a, you know, when you look at somebody and you're like, find your self-worth. It's giving Woodstock, right? But like, how does one do that?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I define unconditional self-worth as the belief that you deserve to be alive, to be loved and cared for, and to take up space just because you're human. So that's the definition that I work with. And the framework that I've created over the years of working with people is this sort of three parts to get there. And the first is to free yourself from the stories that society has told you make you worthy, or the things that make you unworthy, the conditions that you've placed on your worth, the I will be worthy if, I will be worthy when I get the job, the promotion, et cetera, the partner, et cetera. So freeing yourself from that, freeing yourself from the things that you've failed at or made mistakes at by forgiving yourself. And then we look at loving yourself, right? So treating yourself with kindness and compassion. So often we are really harsh and critical to ourselves in a way that we would never be to anyone else, and in a way that we wouldn't allow anyone else to treat us. And so it's about developing a kind and compassionate relationship with ourselves that is affirming and caregiving and supportive. And then the last core part is be yourself. And that's really about tapping into your inner wisdom, your internal wisdom to guide you forward. So if you're letting go of like, I have to keep overworking because I have to prove that I am worthy, and instead saying, okay, what do my wisdom and my values, my intuition guide me to do in this situation? What feels aligned? And then how do you show up authentically in relationships so that you can connect truly and actually receive love for who you are? Those are the core pieces of the work that I guide people through.
So let's talk about be yourself. And this is why, you know, as a corporate woman, people are always like, be yourself, be authentic. And I'm the one in the crowd like, don't do that. You're going to get caught up. They're going to get you. So when you say be yourself, what exactly do you mean? And how does that manifest in professional spaces? Because I'll be frank with you, I do not think that people being their 100% most authentic layered self in the conference room is the way to keep a stable paycheck.
No, I think that's really real. So my mom actually wrote, co-authored the book Shifting, The Double Lives of Black Women in America, came out in 2003. And it's all about the ways that Black women shift to navigate workspaces, corporate spaces, community spaces, partnerships, right? Like all of the shifting that we have to do to fit in, to be accepted, to advance. And I think, you know, there are costs of shifting. It's certainly stressful. There's a lot of things there, but there are benefits, right? In building relationships, in being accepted, right? In navigating stereotypes. And so I think it's very real. What I am not saying is be this, you know, act the way, communicate the way you would communicate with your girlfriends on a Saturday night in the boardroom. But when I talk about authenticity, I think it is really about connecting to your core values and making decisions that are in alignment with your intuition. And I sort of combine that to call it inner wisdom. So this means, what is your value in terms of how you want to show up with people and for you? What is your value in terms of how you want to advocate, how you want to communicate, how you want to share your gifts? And so the way that you say something may change depending on if you're in the boardroom or, you know, with your girls on a Saturday night, but is the value aligned, right? Like, are you advocating for what you think is needs to happen? And that may not happen in the boardroom. Maybe it's a savvy decision. Like, I want to call this out in this boardroom. I know that that's not going to be well received. So I'm going to have an offline conversation with this person who I have a close relationship with and to talk about how do we work on this, right? So it's not just saying be reactive and have no filter and just do and say whatever you want whenever you want. It's intentionally and thoughtfully bringing the core of you, right? Because we express ourselves in various different ways and that changes over time, but often our core values that we want to use to guide us in our life are consistent, and it's using those to show up authentically.
So what have you seen after folks do this work, do this curriculum that you've created, and succeed in that curriculum? What does it look like for them now to walk in their self-worth, whether it is in their professional setting or at home? What is the shift of behavior? What's the new attitude in my Patty voice? Like, what are we doing?
It's such a good question. So it can show up in a number of ways. So for some people, it's leaving a career that was felt toxic and not good and shifting to another career and having the courage to make that shift that was more aligned, right? So that's what it could look like. It could look like, you know, wanting a new opportunity, a new position, and that coming about because they are embodying their truth, because they are showing up for themselves boldly and in their power. It could look like putting themselves out there as an artist and getting more opportunities to share their work. It could look like finding love and partnership after years of trauma and years in therapy, but finally claiming their worth made them available for a healthy, loving, connected partnership, right? So it depends on the person. Sometimes, like I had, you know, one former coaching client say, you know, what she is doing on the outside doesn't look that different, but how she is doing it and how she is approaching these things feels very different for her. So instead of doing a certificate program to prove that she's worthy, she's doing it because she's curious and she's interested and she's excited about how she'll learn and grow. And that experience is going to be so much different than if she was like, okay, I have to get this certificate because then maybe people will recognize me and then I'll be worthy and et cetera, et cetera.
Got it. So it sounds like when you're doing this work or after you've done the work, and I'm sure it's a continuous path until we transition out of this world, but once you start really getting into the work, it sounds like you are then living for you and not for other people. Is that what we're talking about? Like, you are actively every day prioritizing yourself, your needs, and your happiness?
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's also about sharing your gifts, like having, because often people are hiding and playing small. Even if you are overworking and overextending yourself, you may still be hiding and playing small. My last job, my last W-2, I was working a whole lot. I was overextended. I was stressed. I was nearing burnout. But I was playing small because I wasn't really using my gifts and strengths. And that's important to me, right? Is to impact the world in a way that's aligned with my gifts. And so some of it is about prioritizing myself and my needs and holding that. And some of it is about having the courage and the willingness to show up and share the gifts that I have with the world to have the impact that I am hoping to have.
But then it also sounds like... In order to continually do this fully, we also have to talk about personal relationships.
Mm.
I've been in therapy for years, and I remember distinctly when I first started, my therapist said, "Are you in a relationship?" And I said, "No." And she said, "That's totally fine. But I ask because that just brings another layer of your understanding and healing. You can't be with people who are not healed because it'll irritate you or you're going to go back." So my question to you, in personal relationships, when we see women, especially BIPOC women, doing this work, how does it also manifest in their personal relationships?
Yeah, I think that's a big question. I think for some people, it means if you're in a relationship that did not affirm or want to see you with a partner who did not affirm or want to see you in your full power and in a healed space, that relationship is no longer going to work. Right? If you were in a relationship with somebody who held the truth that you are worthy, that you are wonderful, and has been sort of waiting for you to see that in yourself, then that's still going to work, right? But if somebody has been enjoying the fact that you were wounded or playing small or whatever it is, then that relationship is no longer going to fit. And you're probably going to have to transition out of it. What I have found in my own life is that before I was grounded in my worthiness, I was often seeking out relationships with people who were emotionally unavailable because if I could convince them that I was worthy and lovable, then I would believe it myself. But then I was seeking out people who were not likely to affirm it for me. Once I claimed my worth and grounded in that, I, no surprise, met my husband, who is very loving and affirming and sees me as worthy and celebrates my wins and my strength and my power. And so when we own our worthiness, we are one more likely to attract people who find that attractive, right? And appreciate that about us. And we're more likely to be attracted to people who affirm our worthiness.
I agree. I have been in relationships where since I was not doing my self-worth journey in practice, that person did not see it. And when I started it, that relationship didn't work. And then I've been in relation with people that have seen it. And then for folks out there still looking for love, I will tell you, it's so much easier to date when you're on your self-worthy dating journey because it's easy to weed out people.
Yes.
Because you'll be on that first date and the appetizer will come and you'll just be like, nah, this ain't gonna work.
Right. I implemented we need to have a phone call first because I'm really not trying to waste your time or money. I'm not trying to waste my time. I don't need a free meal. Like, let's have a phone call because I can screen. And I think you're right because it's no longer about, will you choose me and affirm that I'm worthy? Okay, if I do all these things, right? Like, that's what it can be about when you're not grounded in your worth. But once you know you're worthy, it's like, can we form a genuine connection? Is this enjoyable? Am I enjoying this conversation? Is it connected, right? That then becomes the assessment. And it's pretty easy to tell early on.
Oh yeah. See, you're nicer than me. I would do I called it a pre-date. So it was like a coffee or a froyo. It was like a 45 minute or smaller. Right. Because you're right. Like, I got food at home. Like, we don't need to be out in public together. Like, I don't know you like that. I love that. I love that. So as we close, where can we find you? Where can people support you? Where can people ask for your services? How do we slide in your DMs and calendar?
Yeah, so you can check out my website, dradiagooden.com. You're welcome to connect with me. I'd love to connect with you on Instagram at Dr. Adia Gooden or on LinkedIn, Dr. Adia Gooden. Either of those places, you can send me a message, send me a DM, let me know. I offer free consultation calls if you're interested in working with me. And I also do a lot of speaking. So if you are, at an organization and you're interested in a speaker talking talking about some of these topics, I'd be happy to have a conversation.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for being with me today in community and having this vulnerable conversation. And thank you for all of the amazing work that you continue to do.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can listen to You Can Sit With Us episodes on Spotify. For more information, visit our website, lexib.com, and our LinkedIn account at LexiB. And make sure to follow our podcasts on Instagram at Sit With Lexi B. And don't forget to subscribe to our Spotify channel.